places that are among the most beautiful anywhere. Stories of Native American culture, industry, and great people that changed a nation and the world. All this and more is included in our national parks, coast to coast. To coincide with the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service this year, we wanted to focus on several of the places in the Midwest that are maintained by the park system. We'd like to take you to several locations around the Great Lakes, beginning with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. It was an Illinois senator, Paul H. Douglas, who pushed for this National Lakeshore at the foot of Lake Michigan. It's where we're walking.
This is a place where you can find some of the best protected natural features in the continent next to some of the most heavily industrialized parts of the continent. So I tell people, you learn how to tilt your head depending on the landscape you wish to view. Just a few degrees either way can change things completely, and it's rather spectacular.
That's Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Superintendent Paul Labovitz, who says this area between Gary and Michigan City is loaded with plant and animal life.
From the lake itself up into the dunes, that change in elevation results in the change of habitat. And so within a relatively short band of land, you have several different ecological systems that are present, each with their own set of plant species that are unique to it. And in such a small area, that's why we have over 1,400 species of vascular plants in the park, making it one of the most biologically diverse places in the system, the national park system in North America.
Over 500 miles away from the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore is another lakeshore. We're standing here now, Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, near Munising, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. This, too, has been formed by the wind, water, and time. They call these rock formations along Lake Superior pictured because of their shape and color. And Park Superintendent Laura Rodegard says the light has everything to do with that.
When the light hits the water and it looks Caribbean blue and green, you have an amazing photograph and an experience on top of that. So yes, the lighting is beautiful here. The Pictured Rocks Cruises, our formal partner, runs sunset and sunrise tours just for photographers. Because the sunset tour, especially when the sun is to our left here and the coast is to the right, backlights everything that you're looking at, and you get a beautiful lighting display on the shoreline that you don't see during high sun during the middle of the day. The sunset cruise is one of the favorite trips here.
We talked on one of the park's beaches, a tranquil place for a good conversation. Rodegard says that tranquility is another asset of Pictured Rocks.
Protecting natural sounds like that is a major part of why we do what we do. You know, the National Park Service wants you all to get that soul fix when you need it. And what we're here to protect is your ability to get that. And a lot of these woods are just, this place, more than any place I've worked, is just so incredibly peaceful. It's the combination of the water and the woods.
To the northwest of Pictured Rocks, nearly in Canadian waters, is an entire island that's become a national park, Isle Royale. Last year was the park's 75th anniversary, and Park Superintendent Phyllis Green says it was the first national park for the state of Michigan and one of the northernmost parks in the country.
It's about as close as to being in Alaska and still in the lower 48, just because it's so cold. It's in the refrigerator, if you will, of Lake Superior, and it's just a unique environment.
And as for hiking?
The hiking is amazing. It's very few people will do the spine of Isle Royale, which when you walk on the Greenstone Trail, you're walking on some of the oldest rock on Earth. It's some of the first lava flows that came out of the oceans. It's that old. So when you get there, it's like a timeless experience. It's really beautiful. And then there, most people don't do that because it may not sound like that much of a distance, but it's quite a hike. It's very strenuous, lots of rock. But there's wonderful short hikes. If you came up and enjoyed the lodge, you could do a couple miles and enjoy yourself. There's lots of ways to experience Isle Royale.
And we're at yet another national lakeshore, the Sleeping Bear Dunes near Traverse City on the coast of Lake Michigan. Acting Superintendent Tom Ulrich says the park with its dunes and woods are remnants of the Ice Age.
These dunes are glacial phenomena. When the ice carved up the Lake Michigan lobe of the glaciers came down, they pushed up these huge moraines jumbles of ground up rock and cobble and boulders on the sides. And then over time, the finer pieces, the sand, were blown up and on top of those moraines. So they're perched dunes. So when you're atop that dune 400 feet above Lake Michigan, you're not standing on 400 feet of sand. You're only standing on, you know, 30 or 40 feet of sand on top of a ridge that was carved up by the Lake Michigan lobe of the glaciers. So after the glaciers retreated, new life sprang up. And so what you have now are these mixed northern hardwood forests that are just go on for acres and acres.
How did the area come to be known as Sleeping Bear? Ulrich says it's a Native American legend that's now the Michigan State Children's Story.
It's based on the Anishinaabe people, who are the Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, who, of course, lived here for millennia prior to European settlement and are still here and good partners to the park. But the story is that over on the Wisconsin side of Lake Michigan, they're going through a big drought, and they were having difficulty in finding any food. There were wildfires and a lack of food, and a mother bear and her two cubs set out across Lake Michigan to try to go and find a living on the other side of the lake, and swam across Lake Michigan. And as they approached the shore on the Michigan side, the mother bear kept calling to her cubs, who were falling behind and faltering after the long swim, "You can make it, children, come along." And she herself just dragged herself out on the top of the high dunes and looked back across Lake Michigan for her cubs. But unfortunately, the cubs did not make it, and they drowned. But the Great Spirit Manitou saw the faithfulness of the mother bear and how she continued to wait for her cubs there, and raised up the Manitou Islands, North and South Manitou Island, to mark the spots where the cubs drowned. So forever, the mother bear looks out over her cubs here at Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore.
We're now on board a boat that takes us to another natural phenomenon, the Apostle Islands on the southwest tip of Lake Superior off northern Wisconsin. Site interpretive director Neil Houck says the islands were given their name by Jesuit missionaries who came to the area in the 1600s.
The maps were remarkably accurate, and the Jesuit missionaries like to name geological locations after biblical references. And the first name we saw on the maps was the Isle de 12 Apostles, or Islands of the 12 Apostles, not 12 Apostle Islands. So it wasn't that they were thinking that there were 12 islands necessarily. They were just naming them after the group.
The Apostle Islands have more lighthouses and light stations than any national park. And for that reason, a special lighthouse exhibit is in the works. David Cooper is an authority on these lighthouses.
Every station's kind of got its own history and sort of different era of technology. That's what's really cool about all these lighthouses. We've got a collection of them showing, you know, all the different eras of architecture and design and the actual technology.
We talked with Cooper and Park Superintendent Bob Krumenacher at the old lighthouse on Michigan Island, now 160 years old. Krumenacher says if you're into lighthouses, this is the place to go.
One of the things that's very exciting about the exhibits that we're going to be putting in here is that, unlike most lighthouse museums where you tell the story of the challenging life of the keeper and his family, which is a great story, but it's been told many times, here it's essentially why here, why now? What's the geopolitical story of this place at this time? And I think that, and we involve the tribes very much in telling that story. So I think for those people who are interested in history and geography, I think they're going to be really excited by the story that we're telling here. I don't think that's been done anywhere else.
But there is one story that illustrates the hazards and loneliness of lighthouse keeping. It goes back to 1831, when Robert Carlson, his wife Anna, and their family lived on Michigan Island. Anna was born in Europe, came to the U.S. as a teenager, and grew up in Chicago. And Cooper related the story to us about one winter day when husband Robert went ice fishing and didn't come back.
There's a story you can see on the park website about her husband, the keeper, going out ice fishing and not returning. And this went on for days, and she just thought he was lost on the lake. And actually, it was a pretty close call. So she's having to take care of the kids, the station, going out milking the cow, all these different things, and freaking out that he's dead out there.
But Robert Carlson did return. He was able to stay afloat on the ice that broke up in Lake Superior and made it back to the island. While we stood atop that 1856 lighthouse, Krumenocker told us of another lighthouse on Raspberry Island and its meaning to America in the time of the Civil War.
That building was opened as a lighthouse in 1863. And if you think about what was going on in the United States in 1863, it was the heart of the Civil War. That was the year of Gettysburg. This was on the far western frontier. And while I don't know the exact number of dollars that the federal government spent, it was a substantial investment to build something on the frontier. And so if that was not a statement of optimism by the Union government that despite this pesky war, the country will survive and we will move west, it's actually a remarkable story. And we had the opportunity to take former Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar out there a few years ago. And I told him that story, and he was just so excited. He said, "This is the story of America." I wish I could have gotten that on film.
Along with the natural beauty protected by the national parks in northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan, industry is a part of their property as well. We're here on the Keweenaw Peninsula, on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, at a place where copper mining flourished not only in the 19th and 20th centuries, but as far back as 7,000 years ago.
The first American Indians came shortly after the last glacier retreated, thousands and thousands of years ago. The oldest metal mining in the Western Hemisphere happened here in the Keweenaw site up in Keweenaw County is dated to almost 8,000 years before present.
Joe Holt is historian at Keweenaw National Historical Park in Calumet, Michigan, not far from Houghton. It was headquarters for the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, which in the 1860s and 70s mined more copper than any place in the world. Holt says the mines attracted workers from everywhere.
The Calumet schools in 1910 counted 40 different nationalities in the classrooms, but I think that was pretty typical of mining regions, industrial regions in general. But yeah, it was a very diverse community in the sense of European diversity, North American diversity.
But workers' rights developed into a divisive issue. As Holt explains, things came to a head in 1913.
Here in the Copper Country, the mining companies began to introduce equipment, mining equipment, that would mean that miners had to work alone. It meant that the miners' workforce was reduced, which then meant that other workers underground couldn't aspire to move up the ladder, so it was limiting mobility and advancement to other workers. And that galvanized everybody to work together. And so in 1913, there was a district-wide copper strike.
On Christmas Eve 1913, a party for striking workers and their families was held at Italian Hall in downtown Calumet. It was there that a holiday celebration and a break from the stress of the strike turned to tragedy. The story goes that during the festivities, someone yelled fire and panic ensued.
No one is really sure what happened or why someone yelled fire, and whether even that itself was a misunderstanding. A lot of different reasons for what happened. Regardless, there was a panic. People fled down the stairs, and as a result, there was congestion, and people were trampled and suffocated. Over 70 people died. Most of them were children. And I think as a result of that and the fallout of that event, it's almost as if the wind went out of people's sails.
Copper mining ended in Calumet in the late 20th century, but some firms are considering the possibility of bringing it back. There are similarities to the Keweenaw and Calumet story at one of the newest national park sites, which happens to be in Chicago. And there's a connection to that site relating directly to our next stop, Springfield, Illinois, and the home of Abraham Lincoln. It's a site the National Park Service has painstakingly restored at the corner of 8th and Jackson Streets in the capital city. As you walk along 8th Street at the intersection of Jackson, the place looks much as it did when Abraham Lincoln was elected here in 1860. Meet our tour guide, Richard Schult.
I'm delighted to do this, and I get to meet people not only from all over the country, but all over the world that come to the Lincoln home, and I never get over the fact that I am walking through the Lincoln home.
Yeah, that's what it means to you, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really does. Yeah. It really does. He's my favorite president. He always has been since I was a kid.
And when he says the world, he's not kidding. From the time the state of Illinois received the property from Lincoln's oldest son, Robert, some 38 million people have passed through that house. While standing in the parlor, Schult will enthusiastically give you a link to American history that happened there on May 19, 1860. That's when a delegation from the Republican National Convention in Chicago asked Lincoln if he would be their candidate for president.
It's on that day a delegation of 20 men has come from Chicago to Springfield on the train and has come to see Mr. Lincoln, okay? They're coming from the Republican National Convention that had just been held. The delegation officially notifies Abraham Lincoln that he's been nominated to be the Republican candidate for president. So in many senses, we can say Abraham Lincoln's formal road to the White House starts right here, in this back parlor room on May 19, 1860.
It was also here on November 6, 1860, that Lincoln told his family he'd been elected president. While that in itself was a happy occasion, Lincoln also knew what was coming. Lincoln Home Site Superintendent Dale Phillips illustrates that.
After his election to the presidency of the United States, coming home to that house in that period between the election and the inauguration, with the nation tearing itself apart, the southern states beginning to secede from the Union, the immense pressure that Abraham Lincoln must have been under is almost unimaginable. The world changed with that weight on his shoulders and the history of our nation.
On February 11, 1861, Lincoln left the only home he ever owned and boarded a train for Washington. Before the train pulled out, he told the crowd he was facing a task greater than that which rested upon George Washington, and that he was leaving not knowing when or whether ever he would return. Following his assassination, Lincoln's body arrived in Springfield on May 3, 1865. His funeral procession passed by the house at 8th and Jackson one final time before his burial in Oak Ridge Cemetery. Robert Lincoln and his brothers, Willie and Tad, grew up in the house in Springfield, and Robert Lincoln is directly linked to Chicago's National Park site. It's where we are now, Pullman. Lincoln's oldest son, Robert, was head of the Pullman Palace Car Company from 1901 to 1911. Pullman was the first planned industrial town in the United States, and it was here in 1894 that a violent labor strike resulted in Congress giving us Labor Day. It's also the place where the first African-American labor union was conceived. National Park Service Director John Jarvis says its stories add to America's story.
The porters, the labor story, and the rise of the African-American middle class, as well as the roots of the Civil Rights Movement, all right here.
Pullman's been one of Chicago's neighborhoods since the 1880s, and Mike Szymanski with the Historic Pullman Foundation says it's still thriving.
We have people that were born here and that are now in their 70s, 80s, 90s that are still living here. And I think that's absolutely cool.
Just one of the many reasons why Pullman is one of the newest park sites. We've only touched on what makes these places special, and we haven't talked about numerous other Midwestern sites, places like the Effigy Mounds and President Herbert Hoover's home in Iowa, the Abraham Lincoln Boyhood Home and the George Rogers Clark Historic Site, both in southern Indiana, the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and the Trail of Tears honoring the survival of the Cherokee people forcibly moved from their homeland. Pictured Rock Superintendent Laura Rodegard has a great take on what these places mean and why they're so important.
This is the summer for everyone to sort of soul search, I think. And go find your park is our kind of motto of the centennial. And I hope we keep the national parks as that little, you know, in our back pocket place where you can always kind of find your connection again and your hope and your positive outlook. Because they're here. They're wonderful places to be part of. The more you learn about them, the more you love them. You know, it's just a gift we have in this country. We have, you know, that we have committed to more than most countries, and it's something that everyone should take part of and pride in. It's yours.
Every person we met and talked with for this report takes great pride in their work and their respective sites. We thank them for their generosity. Our thanks also goes to WGN's Bob Ferguson, Todd Manley, Judy Pilak, Rob Martier, and Bennett Wakenight. I'm Dave Schwann for Chicago's very own 720 WGN.